Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about part 3, chapter 28. Today's episode is brought to you by the brought to you by the beverage tea. Get yours today. Tea is it's a lemon and ginger tea. It's delightful. This is discussion. The discussion prompt. Levin has decided to reverse his farming method. Amazing. Now, probably one of the most pivotal moments in the book. Really, it's what the whole book was about. They were going to call the book a reversal in farming method, but they decided on Anna Karenina. But of course, this is the iconic moment of the novel. Levin's decision to reverse his farming method, and did not disappoint. What an amazing chapter. I almost couldn't believe what I was reading. I put it to you guys. What's your favourite historical reversal of a farming method? Something I think about almost daily, because it's so damn interesting. So, Levin has decided to reverse his farming method. I Am Norwegian says, in reference to the podcast. It's funny, whenever a whenever a modern book deals with current events, I tend to really dislike it. But when old books do it, I have the opposite reaction. Though in all of the books we've read, it's always been about the 19th century, which is the period of time I'm interested in. I tried to find out if Tolstoy wanted the serfs to be freed, or if he just liked their lifestyle as serfs, and apparently Tolstoy tried to free his serfs before it became required by law to do so. This is what happened in War and Peace as well. Who does that? Someone tries to free... Pierre tries to free his serfs. Levin has decided to reverse his farming method. Amazing. Levin flip-flopping on this entire life plan again is hilarious. I suppose it is kind of amusing how he just can't make up his mind about this damn farm. Swim said the mum of fish. He said, I found the flip-flopping again hilarious as well. And then there was this throwaway line, all merged into a feeling of restlessness and an expectation of a speedy solution. I'm fairly certain the peasants are going to have their own notions about Levin's new farming initiative. Speedy solutions are not in his future. Pierre in War and Peace also had the notion to free his serfs. There we go. Pierre does not share the common mindset of other nobles of the time as he has desires to let his serfs go free. He told his stewards that measures would immediately be taken for the complete liberation of the peasants from bondage, that meanwhile the peasants should not be overburdened with work, that women with children should not be sent to work, but that the peasants should be given assistance, that punishments should be administered hortatorily, not corporally, and that there should be hospitals and almshouses and schools in each village. But like Tolstoy, Pierre is unsuccessful because of all the pushback he got. One second, I need to check something. And I'm back, sorry about that. I was just checking that I turned the stove off before because I could smell like a smoky smell and I don't know where it's coming from. But it's not from the stove. All right, Nifty Riffic says, the debate to educate is repetitive. Levin has, having decided this before, it obviously was a hot topic in Tolstoy's time. Even though these topics are a bit repetitive, he is always discussing them with a varied sort. His two brothers, peasants, neighbours, so on, and he is still fluid, thoughtfully trying to solve the agricultural problems of the day. It is easy to gloss over a chapter such as this on occasion, so I can't say for certain whether or not it is so or just my own feel. Or just my own impression. But I feel that he is influenced by each debate, and I'm often left with, wait, how does Levin actually feel? And not only how does he feel, I have no idea how I'm supposed to feel about matters that are archaic and irrelevant to modern life. I want to have an opinion on the education of the 19th century Russian peasants and to speak confidently about this at a dinner party with Tech Riffic, but Where is Tegrific? Oh, actually, I know where Tegrific is. Tegrific had something come up with family members, I think. Because I checked in with Tech the other day, and he said he's just been busy with a family thing happening. So he hasn't abandoned us. He's just taking care of family business, which, you know, we've all got to do it at some time. So, but I do appreciate you pinging him there, Nifty Rific. And I'm sure he does too. Swim said the Mama Fishy says, I hope I'm invited to that dinner party. And the food should be based on Russian recipes with plenty of vodka. Oh dear. Swim said the Mama Fishy also said there is a reference to Spencer. What needs to be cured is poverty. Well, in this, you agree with Spencer, whom you dislike so much. My book doesn't have footnotes, but the reference must be Herbert Spencer, who Tolstoy did dislike. Fun fact, Spencer is best known for the expression survival of the fittest, which he coined in Principles of Biology after reading Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Oh, really? I thought that was a Darwin term. I found this very funny summary of chapter 28. Savatsky and Levin talk about the peasants and educating them and the emancipation of the serfs, and Levin decides that Savatsky is a hypocritical butthole that isn't going to do anything about his thoughts, so Levin leaves in the morning. But Levin was very anti... Well, not anti, but he didn't understand how education would solve the agricultural problems. Or how it would even solve anything for the peasants. He didn't really seem to see the value in education. Strange. Savetsky's anecdote. Imagine that. Imagine if, like, at a time and place where just the idea of, hey, do you think the world would be better if everyone was educated? And that being a topic of debate. Isn't that crazy? What a world. They're being super, like, That's the woke. That's progressive. Thinking that everyone should go to school and believing that that would make things better. I mean, like, I get, you know, maybe for some selfish reasons, maybe they wanted people not to go to school or whatever. But for them to actually doubt, like, would school be beneficial for people? Like, how would they not know that it obviously would be beneficial for everyone? What's the debate? It's so strange. Anyway, Nifty Rific said it. Savetsky's anecdote about the advice to the sick man, you should try an aperient. Aperient. I don't recall ever hearing the word aperient before. It is chiefly of a drug used to relieve constipation. Cool, man. Word power. There we go. Learn something new every day. Aperient.
Aperient.
Aperient. Used to relieve constipation. Very big in the 1800s. I'm looking at the usage over time graph. And dropping down in the 1900s, significantly dropping down. And by 1950, it was almost never used, that word. Well, there we go. So a very archaic and outdated word. Don't go around asking a doctor for an aperient, because they'll wonder why you're using words from the 1800s. Chapter 29 goes like this. The carrying out of Levin's plans presented many difficulties, but he struggled with all his might to retain, if not all he desired, at any rate, a possibility of believing without self-deception that the thing was worth doing. One of the chief difficulties was that the farming was actually going on, and it was impossible to stop it all and start afresh, so that the machine had to be altered while it was working. When, on the evening of his return, he informed the steward of his intentions, the steward with evident pleasure agreed with that part of the plan which showed that all that had been done up to then was foolish and unprofitable. He remarked that he had always said so, but had not been listened to. But to Levin's proposal that he, like the peasants, should participate as a shareholder, would in the farming, the steward only put on a look of great depression, and expressed so definite opinion but at once began to speak of the necessity of carting the last sheaves of rye next day and of starting the second ploughing, so that Levin felt that it was not the time for his plans to be considered. When speaking of the matter to the peasants and offering them land on the new conditions, Levin again met with the same difficulty. They, too, were so fully occupied with the labour of the day that they had no time to consider the advantages and disadvantages of the venture. The naive peasant, the cowman Ivan, quite understood Levin's offer of letting him and his family have a share in the profits of the dairy farm, and quite sympathised with this undertaking. But when Levin impressed upon him the benefit that would accrue to him in the future, a look of anxiety and regret that he could not stop to listen to it all appeared on Ivan's face, and he hurriedly remembered some task that could not be put off, seized a hay fork to remove the hay from the enclosure, fetched water or cleared away the manure. Another stumbling block was the peasant's invincible mistrust of the possibility of a landlord having any other aim than that of robbing them as much as possible. They were firmly convinced that his real aim, whatever he might say, would always be hidden in what he did not tell them. And they themselves, when they talked, said much, but never said what they really wanted. Besides all this, Levin felt that the splenetic landowner was right. The peasants put as the first and unalterable condition in any agreement that they should not be obliged to use any new methods or new kinds of tools for their work. They agreed that an English plough ploughed better, that a scarifier worked quicker, but they found 1,000 reasons why they could not use either the one or the other, and though he was convinced that it would be necessary to lower his standards of farming, he disliked having to give up improvements, the benefit of which was so clear. Yet in spite of all these difficulties he got his way, and by autumn the scheme began to work, or at any rate it seemed so to him. At first Levin thought of letting the whole of his farm as it stood to the peasants, to the labourers, and to his steward, on the new co-partnership lines, but he very soon saw that this was impossible and decided to divide up the different parts, the cattle yard, the fruit and the vegetable garden, the meadows and the cornfields, divided into several parts, should come under different sections. The naive Ivan, who it seemed to Levin best understood that plan, formed an artel. An artel is a workman's profit-sharing association with mutual responsibility common in Russia, consisting chiefly of his own family, and became partner in the dairy section. The far field that had lain fallow for 8 years was, with the aid of the intelligent carpenter Theodore Rezunov, taken up by 6 peasants' families on the new cooperative lines, and the peasant Shurayev rented the vegetable gardens on similar terms. The rest remained as before, but these 3 sections were the beginning of a new order and fully occupied Levin. It is true that the dairy farm did not as yet go on any better than before, and Ivan strongly opposed heating the cow sheds and making butter from fresh cream, maintaining that cows required less food when kept in the cold, and that butter made from sour cream went further, and that he expected his wages to be paid as before, not being at all interested to know that they were not wages but an advance on account of profits. It was true that Theodore Rezunov's group did not plough the corn land twice with the English plough as they had agreed to do, pleading lack of time. It was true that the peasants of that group, though they had agreed to farm the land on the new conditions, did not speak of it as cooperatively held land, but as a land held for payment in kind, and that the members of the group, of that group, and Rezunov himself said to Levin, "If you would only accept money for the land, it would be less trouble for you, and we should feel freer." Moreover, these peasants, on all sorts of pretexts, kept putting off the building of the cattle sheds and granary they had agreed to put up on this land, and dragged the matter on till winter. It was true that Shurayev had taken steps to sublet the kitchen garden in small lots to the other peasants, he evidently quite misunderstood and apparently intentionally misunderstood the conditions on which the land was let to him. It was true that often when talking to the peasants and explaining to them the advantages of the plan, Levin felt that they were only listening to the sound of his voice and were quite determined, whatever he might say, not to let themselves be taken in. He felt this especially when talking to the most intelligent of them, Rezunov, and noticing the play in his eyes, which clearly indicated his derision of Levin and a firm resolve that if anyone was taken in, it should not be Rezunov. But in spite of this, Levin thought matters were getting on, and that by keeping strict accounts and insisting on having his way, he would eventually be able to prove to the peasants the advantage of these new arrangements, and that things would then go on of themselves. These affairs added to the rest of the farming, which remained on his hands, and the indoor work on his book, so filled Levin's whole summer that he hardly ever made time to go out shooting. At the end of August, he heard from a servant who brought back the side saddle that the Oblonskys had gone back to Moscow. He felt that by not having answered Dolly Oblonskaya's letter, a rudeness he could not remember without blushing, he had burned his boats and could never visit there again. He had treated the Savatskys just as badly, having left their house without saying goodbye, but neither would he ever visit them again. That made no difference to him now. The rearrangement of his farming interested him more than anything had ever done in his life. He read through the books lent him by Savatsky, and having ordered various others that he required, he read books on political economy and socialistic books on the same subject. But as he had expected, he found nothing in them related to his undertaking. In the works of political economy, in Mill, for instance, which he studied first and with great ardour, hoping every moment to find a solution of the question that occupied him, he found various laws deduced as governing the state of agriculture in Europe, but he could not see why these laws, inapplicable to Russia, should be considered universal. It was the same with the socialistic books. They were either beautiful but inapplicable fancies which had carried him away when he was still at the university, or they were improvements and patchings up of the order existing in Europe, with which agricultural affairs in Russia have nothing in common. Political economy maintained that the laws by which the wealth of Europe had developed and is developing are universal and unquestionable laws. The socialistic teaching declared that development on those lines lead to ruin, but neither the one set of books nor the other so much as hinted at explaining what Levin and all the Russian peasants and landowners with their millions of hands and acres should do to make them as productive as possible for the general welfare. Having taken up this question, he conscientiously read everything relating to it, and he purposed going abroad in the autumn to study the question further there, so that what had often happened to him with other questions should not be repeated. Often, just as he was beginning to understand the idea in his interlocutor's mind and to explain his own, he would suddenly be asked, "And what about Kaufman and Jones and Du Bois and Michelet? Have you not read them? You should do so. They are elucidated the question. They have elucidated the question." He now clearly saw that Kaufman and Michelli had nothing to tell him. He knew what he wanted. He saw that Russia had splendid soil and splendid labourers, and that in some cases, such as that of the peasant at the halfway house, the labourers and land produced much. But that in the majority of cases, when capital was expended in the European way, they produced little, and that this happened simply because the labourers are only willing to work and work well in the way natural to them, and that their opposition was not accidental but permanent, being rooted in the spirit of the people. He thought that the Russian people, whose mission it is to occupy and cultivate enormous unoccupied tracts of land deliberately as long as any land remains unoccupied, kept to the methods necessary for that purpose, and that those methods are not at all as bad as is generally thought. This he wanted to prove theoretically in his book and practically by his farming. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. More farm talk. Oh my god, the farm talk is endless in this book. I gotta say, like, I was liking the whole, like, Levin goes and becomes a farmer, and it was kind of idyllic and quaint. You know, it was nice. But by now, it's getting a little old. The whole farm thing's getting a little old. So, what do you think? Have your say. Go head over to the subreddit, have a little chit-chat. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.